Hello and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding areas. This is the primary edition for the week ending Saturday, the 8th of May, 2021. My name is Ian, I edit and produce this programme. Well, last week I received my second shot of the Oxford vaccine. Excellent news. I'm also the proud owner of two free packs of the lateral flow tests, rather ominously and worryingly, made in China. Gilly and I have been tremendously saddened to see the state of the pandemic in India. Last year, just before the first lockdown, we were privileged to be able to spend 2 weeks on holiday in that wonderful country. We can't wait to go back, sometime in the future. I wasn't aware that India is the world's biggest manufacturer of vaccines. Let's hope they divert their output to the domestic market. I understand also that the UK now has more vaccines than it can use, so let's hope that nice Mr. Johnson puts some on a plane to where they can do some good. This edition of Primary will again be distributed on USB sticks. Please remember to return them in the wallet provided when you have finished listening. Additionally, the programme is available on our website, sadtn.org.uk, under Listen Online. If you are using a mobile device, it's available via the British Wireless for the Blind Fund app. This can be downloaded free via iTunes or Google Play. Search for Talking Newspaper. You can also tune in to local life on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM and catch some news and other items you might find of interest in the programme hosted by Rob Pearman on Sundays 8 to 9am and 6 to 7pm and on Wednesdays at 7pm. This edition has, on the USB stick distribution only, the BBC In Touch podcast. We'll also have the usual news roundup and the national radio listings read by John Cushing. And once again, we'll be delving into the Vocalise London Beyond Sight archives. This time, Lynn Featherston describes Alexandra Palace. Continuing my love affair with New York, I'll be playing an American Vocalise piece. Beth Gorry describes the Staten Island Ferry. I hesitate to use the word iconic yet again, but it is. To finish, I'll be looking at past events and birthdays in the week. This week's music is Happy Strumming by Gothby. Let's move on to the news now, read by Gilly, Deborah, Christine, Jane, Jess, Andy, Keith and David.
Hello, I'm Jessica. 14 festivals planned for Greenbelt site. At least 14 different applications have been submitted to license an outdoor site in St Albans for festivals. Each one of the applications seeks permission to run festivals, lasting up to 3 days, at Springfield Farm on Old Parkbury Lane. The bids were considered individually by members of St Albans Council's licensing subcommittee. But even if SADC refuses to grant the licences, it has been suggested that the festivals could still go ahead because of the existing premises licence. A number of residents had objected to the applications, pointing to concerns about noise and public nuisance, and references were made to the tear-out festival at the site in 2019, which had led to dozens of noise complaints. Gary Davis, chair of the Knapsbury Park Residents Association, said the 1,300 residents in Knapsbury Park were in the direct line of fire of the speaker system. Mr. Davis said their objections stemmed from their experiences of the tear-out event in 2019, when sound levels meant residents could not sit out in their gardens or open their windows. He said sound monitoring of events at the venue should be undertaken by independent contractors. Another objector, Alex Mathewson, said sound levels were higher because of the site's proximity to the M25. He warned that the applications for so many festivals were a creeping development of the Greenbelt. A number of written objections also highlighted disturbances from previous festivals, which were said to be extremely noisy and disruptive and out of character with the Greenbelt. One objection states, "My house is located around half a mile away from the site, and yet we can still hear the extremely loud music for hours on end." Solicitor Bernard Ralph said the reason for the separate applications was that site operator Vikram Jashapara wanted each applicant to take as much responsibility as possible for the operation of the events. But he added, "If we are not successful with our application, we have still got a premises licence application that we can rely on to provide licensable activities." He suggested there had been no noise breakout from the site aside from the event in 2019. He also suggested that since 2019, some residents had assumed noise had come from the Springfield site when it had not. I think this is a very responsibly run venue. That's proven by the fact that, apart from one event, there have been no real issues with its operation. We have heard a lot of conjecture about what it could be doing and how much impact it might have, but we've had no detailed specific examples effectively supporting that. Mr. Ralph also pointed to the absence of any representations from responsible authorities against any of the applications, which he suggested did speak volumes. I think we should be given an opportunity to contribute to the economy locally, and I think this licensed venue does that. And it does provide good opportunities for people who are in sore need of something to do now life is getting somewhat back to normal. At the hearing, councillors were told that under the terms of the proposed conditions, each applicant would be limited to one event per calendar quarter, and each event limited to a maximum of 3 days. Theoretically, that could have given the green light to 32 separate festivals in a year. But at the meeting, an amendment was suggested by the applicant that would limit events at the site to 28 days a year. Site operator Vic Josh also told the hearing that this year those events would be scheduled between the end of June and the end of September. The hours of opening and for the sale of alcohol requested on the applications varied, with the latest running until 2 a.m. Councillors who deliberated in private after the public hearings have yet to publish their decisions.
Hello, my name's Deborah, and my first article is entitled Scandal of Epic Proportions, MP Slams Fire Safety Bill. MP Daisy Cooper has condemned the financial burden of making homes across the UK fire safe as a national scandal of epic proportions. Buildings with unsafe cladding and fire safety defects are affecting thousands of people across the country, including hundreds in St Albans. This week, the Fire Safety Bill passed into law, despite attempts to persuade the government to fix the bill or let it fall and introduce a better version in the next Queen's Speech. Last year, Daisy joined the Fire Safety Bill Committee, the cross-party group of MPs scrutinising the government's proposed new laws, after meeting with local residents who discovered their homes were not fire safe. She tabled an amendment to the bill that introduced the principle that no leaseholder or tenant should have to pay for fire safety defects not of their making, but the bill was passed without this being added on. Now, thousands of homeowners could receive extortionate bills for safety improvements, perhaps within a matter of days. Daisy said, "Nearly 4 years on from the Grenfell tragedy, and millions of homeowners, including hundreds of residents in St Albans, are still living in death traps, facing exorbitant costs to fix the fire safety defects. Some have declared bankruptcy. Some are homeless. Tens of thousands are struggling with their mental health." Boris Johnson promised that no leaseholder should have to pay for the unaffordable costs of fixing safety defects. Yet this is another promise broken. The government has had 10 whole months to break the deadlock and propose a solution that they find acceptable, but they have refused to compromise. They have turned their back on those who are dealing with the devastating consequences of the cladding crisis. Leaseholders themselves said they would rather that this bill fell and didn't pass into law without the vital financial protections, but the Conservative government just refused to listen. The government's handling of this crisis is a national scandal of epic proportions. Daisy is supporting the National Cladding Action Group, which is calling on the government to cover the costs up front so as to make millions of homes fire safe as quickly as possible, then to set up a scheme to claw the money back from those responsible, including developers. Alison Hills, who owns a flat in St Albans with her father that has flammable cladding, insulation and other fire safety issues, said, "We bought the flat in good faith, having completed all the right surveys and paid professionals' fees. When we first found out, a waking watch was put in place, which was a total joke because all they did was sit around on their phones. They never patrolled the building like they were supposed to, and they were actually increasing the fire safety risks by blocking fire exits, overloading power cables, and falling asleep on the job. We were paying £400 per month each for this service. Also, the more we found out from the Grenfell inquiry, the more my mental health was negatively and hugely affected. I couldn't sleep, couldn't eat, couldn't concentrate. I'd have nightmares every night about facing a choice of having to jump from my balcony or burn to death. I was terrified at the prospect of having to pay a £150,000 bill, which could cause bankruptcy. I was experiencing suicidal thoughts and was in tears every night. Eventually, I just had to move out. I'm now renting somewhere else and the flat is empty. My mental health has now improved because I know I'm living somewhere safe, but I still worry about my financial future and my dad's. Neither he nor I nor the 3 million other leaseholders across the country who are innocent victims of a government-fuelled corruptive scam deserve this. I'm absolutely outraged at the result of the fire safety bill. But thankful to Daisy and the Lib Dems, who are the only party who have demonstrated to us that they truly care about us, the innocent victims, and are willing to fight this to the bitter end.
This is Keith McDougall. Man detained after sending bomb threats and explicit emails. A man who sent sexually explicit emails and bomb threats to his local MP and to two schools in St Albans has been given a hospital order. Bonham Meyer, who has paranoid schizophrenia, is to be detained indefinitely under the Mental Health Act. Prosecutor Jane Davis told St Albans Crown Court that in September 2019, Meyer, now 40, sent emails to Anne Main, the former St Albans MP, to Mandeville Primary School and to Marlborough School. She said they included bomb alerts, sexually explicit content and references to drugs. The offensive references caused the recipient's distress. Hearts Police were contacted and Meyer, who'd used his own email address, was traced to his home in Martin's Court in St Albans, where they found crystal meth, ecstasy and cannabis. Meyer was unfit to plead to 4 charges of sending grossly offensive communications, 2 of possessing Class A drugs and 1 of possessing Class B drugs. A jury found that he'd carried out the acts in the charges. He was of previous good character. He's also been charged with sending similar emails to the magistrate and to Crown Courts. The CPS is to review those charges following the sentencing hearing. Psychiatrist Dr. Michael Short told Judge Philip Gray, Meyer would benefit from being under a hospital order. He has delusions and poor insight. I think he would pose a risk to others and is liable to send such communications again. Mr. Meyer was of the view that there was not a real offence and there was a conspiracy involving police and colleagues to get him into trouble because he is of Asian heritage. He believed his mental health was God-given and linked to Mother Nature. Dr. Short said Meyer had not been making progress while being treated in the community. Defending Jonas Milner said Meyer had been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia since 2012. He is frightened and scared of what might happen. He has an incredibly heartbreaking history. He is a vulnerable person who is confused and scared. He is sorry for the offences. He wishes to be a law-abiding member of society. Judge Gray told Meyer the emails were deeply concerning. They were incoherent and not the product of a well mind. They caused considerable distress and alarm. It is completely unsurprising that Anne Main, her family and those at the schools were so alarmed in what they read. The judge made a hospital order to detain him at the Beach Ward in Radlett. You continue to pose a substantial risk of causing distress and fear. The focus of the order is to protect the public and rehabilitate you.
Hello, this is Jane Wilson. My first piece today is casts announced for Open Air Theatre Productions. Performers set to appear at this summer's Roman Theatre Open Air Festival have been announced. Creatives at theatre company OVO have confirmed the casts for its productions of Peter Pan, The Comedy of Errors and The Winter's Tale, which are to be performed outdoors at the Roman Theatre of Verulamium in St Albans. Running from May 28th to July 12th, the mouth-watering programme of shows at the Roman Heritage Site is designed to appeal to the widest audiences. This year's festival will be headlined by productions created and performed by the Malting Theatre's in-house company, OVO. The open-air festival on the Roman Theatre stage kicks off with a revival of OVO's swashbuckling Christmas production of Peter Pan, which opens on May 28th and features music, song and acrobatic surprises. The Comedy of Errors will then be set in a beachfront karaoke bar, while The Winter's Tale stars none other than the Malting Theatre's artistic director, Adam Nichols, as Leontes. The Peter Pan cast features many of the original cast who performed in the show at the Auburn Arena last December, before the theatre was closed in the last lockdown. Felipe Pacheco is the eponymous hero. Emma Wright plays Mary Darling and Tiger Lily. Flora Squires is Wendy Darling. And Marcus Churchill is George Darling and the swashbuckling Captain Hook. The show features at least two directors. Matthew Parker, who plays the lovable Nana and Smee, will be directing The Comedy of Errors, while Luke Adamson, who is cast as Urchin and Tootles, recently directed The Removal Service for the Maltings Theatre. The Removal Service was co-written by Will Pattle, who plays Michael Darling in Peter Pan. William Shakespeare's The Comedy of Errors will be set by the sea in a karaoke bar. Award-winning director Matthew Parker said, "Think Brighton Beach, an end of pier style for our production of The Comedy of Errors. I love this play. It's really funny and has all the zip and pace of a classic farce, but with really funny characters and lots of room for physical comedy. I've decided that two of the characters in our production run a beachfront karaoke bar, which means that the show will be liberally peppered with karaoke classics throughout, as well as hipsters, drag queens, fortune tellers and nuns." The multi-talented cast of The Comedy of Errors features Claire Bloomer, Sam Denyer, Oliver Lines, Sheetal Kapoor and Rhys Pantry in multiple roles. Maltings Theatre favourite David Widdowson and newcomers William Donaldson, Gabriel Fogarty-Graveson, Lewis Jenkins, Rosie Edwards and Phoebe Marshall. The Bard's The Winter's Tale is co-directed by the Maltings Theatre artistic director Adam Nichols, who also performs as King Leontes, and Janet Pod. "This is such a wonderful play," says Janet. "Like so much Shakespeare, it encompasses the human experience, devastating jealousy, redemption, joy, and while there are highly comic scenes, there are scenes of tragedy too. And there are two distinct worlds, those of Celia and Bohemia, which will be specifically distinguished in our production through set design, costume and performance. Adam and I have co-directed before, and I also directed him in The Crucible. It really works for us. There's collaborative process and we trust each other's instincts." The Winter's Tale is led by Adam Nichols as Leontes, and Adam's real-life son Finn Nichols plays Leontes' son Maximilius. Matt Betteridge plays Polixenes, Guido Garcia-Luesch is Antigonus Autolycus, Sam Claridge and Emilia Harold play Florizel and Perdita, and the Maltings Theatre's regular company members Will Pattle, Emma Wright, Lucy Crick and Anna Franklin round off the cast. Fans of the Maltings Theatre will know that Anne Franklin recently directed the Regina Monologues, which featured Lucy Crick as Jane Seymour. The Roman Theatre of Verulamium is in Blue House Hill. Sales for the productions are now available from the Maltings Theatre website.
Hi, I'm Andy. The headline for this article is "Anger at Police Failure to Act Over Destruction of Vital Wildlife Site." Continued failings to take action against the ongoing destruction of a vital wildlife environment have resulted in outspoken criticism of Harts Police. As extensively reported by the Harts Advertiser, Smallford Pits has been devastated by pollution and intensive construction work, including the destruction of ponds, trees and other plant life, leaving it as little more than a muddy wasteland. The area was previously a local wildlife site, which identified it as a crucial location for wildlife in the county and should have protected it from development by the planning system. It had been a breeding ground for great crested newts and was also an important area for dragonflies. In September, the ponds on the site were dredged and scrub cut to the ground, and in December, fuel was dumped in the water. A JCB later levelled the plant life, including felling trees, which neighbours believe has caused further damage to the environment. Although the Environment Agency considered the damage to constitute a wildlife crime, the police and Crown Prosecution Service decided not to take action due to insufficient evidence and an inability to identify the owner of the land. An internet search reveals the land is owned by a company called Colney Smallford Limited, based in Milton Keynes, but nobody from the firm has been formally interviewed by police. Matt Dodds, Planning and Biodiversity Manager at Hearts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust, said, "We are hugely disappointed by this development. As a local wildlife site, Smallford Pits was an incredibly important place for wildlife. The devastating news that another crime against wildlife has gone unpunished highlights the urgent need for a stronger protection of our wild places." Neighbour Christine Pedder, who first reported the destruction, has made a formal complaint about what she perceives to be failings in the police investigation. "The police were extremely slow to gather the necessary statements and at one point suggested they had a problem with identifying the owners of the land. In light of the apparent inability of the police to investigate, they were provided with witness statements, photographic evidence and ecological survey evidence of protected species living there. The owner had in fact identified himself to one witness as he was pumping the remaining water out of one of the dredged ponds. Local police say the CPS were contacted on an informal basis and it was decided that there wasn't enough evidence to warrant a prosecution. I have been told the owner of the land was never interviewed and the time limit for prosecution has lapsed. I am forced to conclude that the police have not acted appropriately in this instance and failed in protecting the environmental heritage of the community they purport to serve. There is an overwhelming public interest in the investigation and prosecution of environmental crime, particularly when the perpetrator has been identified. The failure of local police to properly investigate or even interview in the light of evidence presented by concerned members of the public is a horrible and inexplicable dereliction of duty. I would very much appreciate an explanation from the CPS as to why it was felt that this case did not warrant a prosecution, and from the police as to why they did not interview the landowner and why they took so long to gather evidence." County Councillor for Colney Heath and Marshalswick, Councillor John Hale, said, "The failure of the police to take action shows how weak the law is when it comes to protecting nature and how overstretched the police are. The current legislation is inadequate to stop developers spoiling sites prior to making planning applications. This might change if the government proceeds with the proposed Environment Bill, but that was delayed yet again earlier this year. This is the third time the government has delayed this bill. In the meantime, residents are seeing open spaces they have enjoyed for many years being destroyed. As a local councillor, I am frustrated that there is no means to stop this happening. On this site, there was evidence of protected species, but the police have failed to take action even when there is legal protection available. A formal complaint about the lack of police action has been submitted to the Complaint Resolution Team in the Office of the Police and Crime Commissioner, although this will not result in police reinvestigating the alleged offences." A spokesperson for Hearts Police said, "I can confirm that a complaint has been made and is currently being reviewed. As a formal complaint has been made, it would be inappropriate for us to comment any further at this time."
Hello, my name's Christine Stanley. My first item is entitled, "Young People Invite Politicians to Talk About Climate Crisis." a group of young people are hosting an event to ask local politicians about the climate crisis. The online event, Activism and Optimism with Local Politicians, is aimed at 14 to 27-year-olds and will include MPs Bim Ofalami and Daisy Cooper, plus Green Party councillor Simon Grover. It takes place on Wednesday, June the 2nd, as part of the 2021 St Albans Sustainability Festival. Jess Simmons, who's 18, one of the event organisers and a member of the Youth Advisory Group for Sustainable St Albans, said, "As a young person, I and many other young constituents see local politicians' policies on climate change as the most important factor to inform our voting decisions. The greatest issue my generation faces is the climate crisis. So I'm excited to create an event where young people get to have conversations about these issues with their politicians." Alongside Jess on the newly formed advisory group are Niamh McElvogue, who's 22, Nina Vinther and Maddie Liver, who's 23. The event aims to create an honest conversation on the climate and biodiversity crisis and discuss how politicians can amplify young voices. Niamh said, "Having recently returned to St Albans from university, it's been encouraging to see the progress that's been made in tackling the climate crisis since I left. Involving and listening to the younger generation will be vital to continue on this path, with climate change being an issue that will disproportionately affect them. I hope this event will be valuable in getting younger people's voices heard and empower them to be able to take the actions they need towards a greener future." Trustees of Sustainability St Albans, Dan Fletcher, said, "It's inspiring to see young people moving forward with urgency on climate issues. They've organised an extremely interesting session, which should be challenging for all the guests, and a great introduction to environmental issues for all local young people. To book an event, you can go to the website, which is www.activismandoptimism.evenbright.uk. Under 18s will require their parents and guardians' email address to book."
Hello, David Ireson here with a couple of items from this week's Hearts Advertiser. Daisy Cooper opens new school playground. A long-awaited new school playground has been officially opened by St Albans MP Daisy Cooper. The children and teachers of Maple Primary School in Hall Place Gardens, St Albans, celebrated the opening of their new playground equipment after a massive fundraising effort organised by the Parent Teachers Association, the PTA. It took more than 2 years to plan and raise funds for the playground project, with progress hindered due to the pandemic. The entire school watched the event in their class bubbles as Daisy Cooper cut the ribbon, helped by the oldest and youngest pupils of the school. The apparatus included a trim trail for the junior area, formerly an unused muddy area, and a log climber for the infant area, replacing 20-year-old equipment which had reached the end of its life. The fundraising drive included a reindeer dash for cash before Christmas, in which the children wore reindeer antlers and ran as many laps of a running track as they could to gain sponsorship from their friends and family, raising as much as £4,000 in the process. The grand opening was the end of a special week for the school. Shanti Johnson completed her first week as interim head teacher, following the departure of Timothy Bowen at the end of the last term after a 20-year tenure as head. Mrs. Johnson said, "It was a pleasure to welcome Daisy Cooper to our school to celebrate the new playground equipment and the beginning of a new era." Also in attendance were Abigail Miller on behalf of Maple School PTA and Assistant Head Matt Withers. Daisy Cooper said, "I was so pleased to be invited to open this fantastic new playground. I hope it gives the children at Maple Primary School many happy hours to play, explore and exercise now and for years to come. A big well done to the PTA for their heroic fundraising efforts and an even bigger well done to the children who helped, some of whom ran as many as 100 laps during the reindeer dash for cash. Considering the school has only 250 pupils, raising £4,000 in sponsorship for one event alone is impressive indeed.
Hello, this is Gilly. London Coney GP to retire after 52 years in the NHS. A London Coney GP is retiring after more than half a century working in the NHS. Dr. Push Parkedia joined the NHS in 1969, having completed her medical training in Jaipur, Rajasthan, India, initially as an anaesthetist in Farnborough before moving to St. Albans. She took up her general practitioner post at Coney Medical Centre with her late husband, Dr. Nawal Kedia, in 1975, and will be stepping down at the start of July. Although she has seen the NHS change dramatically over the last half a century, she has remained stoic and steadfast in her commitment to it. General practice is the backbone of the health service, and I am proud to have been part of it for so many years. One of her biggest enjoyments from her job has been talking to her patients, which has been made more difficult due to the COVID pandemic, as most of the medical work has had to be done either over the phone or via video call. The last 12 months have been the most challenging yet for the NHS and the practice, but I hope that things will slowly return to normal and I can start physically seeing patients once again. Her son, Dr. Nitil Kedia, who also works at the practice, said, "She has formed unique bonds with several generations of her patients since becoming a GP in London Coney, and has found that getting to know her patients is critical to helping their physical and mental health needs. Often her patients comment that in addition to the exceptional medical advice, she has also provided them with helpful life advice, and so has been more than just their doctor. She will often be the first person through the door and the last to leave at night. It is through this career-long dedication that she has earned the respect of her patients and her colleagues, so much so that she was invited to meet the Prime Minister at a reception in Downing Street in 2005. She will be sorely missed by her patients and the staff at the practice. Dr. Kedia is looking forward to spending more time at home, in the garden, and with her grandchildren following her retirement."
Stephen Lawrence Day. A special youth engagement event was held in St. Albans to mark Stephen Lawrence Day. The day was established by Prime Minister Theresa May in 2019 on the 25th anniversary of Stephen's death, to allow people to reflect upon the part we all play in creating a society in which everyone can flourish. This year, a youth engagement session was run locally by the Next Generation Youth Club in collaboration with Sopwell Community Trust, Hearts Police, Marlborough Science Academy and Kickoff at 3, with the aim of encouraging young people to share community issues which are important to them. Places were limited to 10 people in accordance with COVID guidelines, and participants became involved in the Stephen Lawrence Foundation's community social activity by writing their own hashtag because of Stephen pledges. Organiser Shelley Hales said, "Funding and grants are often given to white-led organisations who, despite their good intentions, have little understanding of BAME issues or are unable to reach or engage the communities they set out to help. The success of the work that I've been doing has been down to hand-picking the best people with the necessary skills, qualifications and lived experience, and I will continue to do this."
Church roof saved thanks to lottery grant. The long-awaited repair of a 900-year-old church's roof is finally set to go ahead following a grant from the National Lottery. St. Leonard's in Flamstead will be closed until the summer while the nave roof is repaired and other major works carried out. The National Lottery Heritage Fund has awarded a new grant of £642,500 to add to £92,000 they have already donated. The Flamsteed Heritage Project was set up to save the 12th century village church from closure, and as well as carrying out these vital repairs, sought to establish the church as a heritage venue, where people of all ages will enjoy discovering the stories of those who have left their mark on it over 900 years. The church can now afford to repair the failing medieval roof timbers and leaking stonework to make the building weatherproof. Craftspeople skilled in woodwork, stonemasonry and structural repair will combine their skills to ensure that the Grade 1 listed building retains as much of the original material as possible while being made safe and secure for the coming centuries. A spokesperson for Flamsteed Heritage said, "After 3 years' really hard work to develop our project proposals and raise over £250,000 of matched funding, we are absolutely delighted that the National Lottery Heritage Fund has awarded us a grant of up to £642,500, which will enable us to save St Leonard's from closure and share its heritage with many more people. Villagers have already helped raise £285,000 of matched funding through a variety of activities, including the annual Scarecrow Festival. Some of this money will go towards a three-year project aimed at expanding the church's activities. Schools will be able to participate in puppet, drama and storytelling projects. Young people will also help to design new web-based exploration experiences. Ecology projects will help to reuse old organ pipes for bat and bird boxes. And history will be brought to life through talks and tours with optional cream teas. Volunteers will be offered training in new skills, like recording living memories, overseeing Duke of Edinburgh Award participation, doing a photographic survey of medieval graffiti, and hosting visitors, all as part of what will be a major community project."
St Albans Man takes over as Chair of Trustees helping orphans in Zambia. A St Albans Man is honoured to have taken over as Chair of the Trustees for a charity helping orphans in Zambia. Zambia Orphans Aid, or ZOA, was founded by Dr. Shimwayi Mutemba as a response to the AIDS crisis that hit the country and left many children orphaned. Garnet Malomo, a British Zambian who was born in Chingola, said that he is honoured to have been invited to lead ZOA's response, and he praised the hands-on approach that the organisation takes. With his mother and many members of his family still living in Zambia, Garnet has maintained strong links with the country and has been working on expanding his Zambian network. Having previously worked with a different organisation which also helped Zambian orphans, Garnet was introduced to ZOA and the work they were doing resonated with him as he felt they were going to the heart of the problem. Through his experience in construction, Garnet, who has a Master's in Construction Management at Leeds University, has already played a major role in the work of the ZOA since he became a trustee 3 years ago, working on some of ZOA's infrastructure projects, including the building of vital toilet facilities and boarding houses at schools in Zambia. The St Albans resident has echoed this focus on education since taking on his new role, identifying it as one of the most sustainable ways we can support an orphaned child and as having the longest long-term impact. In Twafwane School, Garnet explained, there are 100 children crammed into a 5-metre by 6-metre classroom, so work is being done to build new classrooms. He also recognises that the approach taken in giving access to education is diverse, and he gave an example of a successful menstrual hygiene initiative which was run 18 months ago. Garnet explained that the programme was educating not just the girls, but the boys and community leaders to increase understanding that it's not taboo and that it's just natural, and that since the initiative, there's evidence that the girls who were staying at home at that time of the month are now coming to school. He also identified international development charities, such as ZOA, as being vital in reversing the first rise in global poverty since 1998, which has been caused by the coronavirus pandemic. He said, "A story that touched me came from our partner, Twafwane School. The kids are supposed to come to the school for education, but they also come to be fed. a girl of about 6, always kept her egg that she was given as part of her breakfast at school in the morning. The teachers noticed this and tried to get to the bottom of it. They found that the girl was taking the egg home for her little brother because he didn't have anything to eat at home and was too young to go to school. Hearing this story really tugs at my heartstrings and shows how far-reaching we can be. The impact isn't just directly on the ones at school, but the help is reaching into their homes. Looking forward, Garnet wishes to help in a sustained way, supporting the children in the long term until they can stand on their own 2 feet. Looking forward, Garnet wishes to help in a sustained way, supporting the children in the long term until they can stand on their own 2 feet. In Chibola, Kafui, a community school, has built a vegetable plot and started fish farming, which ZOA are helping so that they can begin to support themselves and do not have to rely on the aid of others. Through this process of helping in a sustainable way, he says, there is a tendency for the children who've been helped to want to give back. Upon stepping down as chair after 15 years, Garnet's predecessor, Lord Turnbull, said that he has witnessed the difference that going to school has had on the lives of the young people we work with, and that he knows that Garnet will continue to help change the future for many more children in Zambia. In 2019-2020, ZOA supported 2,000 children through supplying uniforms and books, tuition and exam fees, nutrition school meals, and helping school leavers find vocational training opportunities. Garnet said, I'm taking over at a time when we have some real challenges ahead of us. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, we're seeing the first rise in global poverty since 1998. But I believe that small international development charities like ZOA are absolutely vital in reversing this trend.
Therapist is fundraising for charity that helped friend. A St Albans therapist is fundraising for a mental health charity which helped her best friend through her darkest days. Nadia Giffen, who runs a therapy studio in the Quadrant, Marshalswick, is donating a percentage of her fees for massage and reflexology sessions to Mind in Mid Hearts. She explained why she was inspired to help. I first heard about Mind in Mid Hearts when my dearest friend Shona needed their services a few years ago. I will always be grateful for the help they gave her and also for the help they give to so many others. This is one of the main reasons I've continued to support this wonderful charity and the amazing work they do. Fast forward to lockdown. It has been a difficult year for so many, and as a result, more people have been struggling with their mental health, in particular during the winter months. A lot of charities have been impacted by lockdown restrictions, which is another reason I've wanted to carry on supporting them. During the winter lockdown, I decided to use my skills as an instructor to teach online classes in return for donations to Mind in Mid Hearts. With lockdown easing and gyms reopening, I'm winding down my online classes, but I'm keen to continue supporting Mind in Mid Hearts through my work as a complementary therapist. We know the positive effect massage has on the mind and body in bringing stress levels down and promoting feelings of well-being. Mental Health Awareness Week is coming up in May, and as its theme is nature and the environment, I've chosen aromatherapy massage and reflexology. Adele Hemmings from Mind in Mid Hearts said, "We've seen our referrals double in the last 3 months, and therefore we depend on our supporters such as Nadia to help us meet the growing need of the community. Being a local mind, we are responsible for our own funding. Therefore, every penny Nadia raises for us will go back into supporting the people of Hertfordshire. Thank you, Nadia, for your ongoing support, especially during the pandemic." For every aromatherapy massage with Nadia booked between May the 10th and June the 10th, Mind will receive £20. And for every aroma reflexology treatment booked, they will receive £15.
Events licence granted to Harpenden Secondary School. A Harpenden Secondary School has been granted a premises licence for music and the sale of alcohol for events that could run as late as 2 a.m. Officials at the Catherine Warrington School on Lower Luton Road applied for the licence in order to run their own events and to hire out facilities for private events. At a hearing of St Albans District Council's licensing subcommittee, councillors were told that it would ensure the PTA could run events to raise much needed funds for the school. It was also suggested that in seeking the licence, the school was following the lead of several other schools in the area. A number of residents objected to the application, highlighting the potential for noise nuisance, antisocial behaviour, parking issues and concerns relating to public safety. And amongst the written objections was a suggestion that the continuous licence could allow the school to act like a nightclub. Councillors considered the application in private following the meeting and decided to grant the application. But they've added conditions designed to ensure residents are not disturbed by noise after 11 p.m. According to the licence, the school will be allowed to hold events that run until 11:30 p.m. Sunday to Thursday and 2 a.m. on Fridays and Saturdays. And they will be allowed to sell alcohol between noon and 10:30 p.m. Sunday to Thursday and 1:30 a.m. on Fridays and Saturdays. Music, live or recorded, can be played until 10:30 p.m. Sunday to Thursday. And on Fridays and Saturdays, recorded music can be played until 11:30 p.m. and live music until midnight. In advance of the hearing, conditions had been agreed that the number of outdoor events with music later than 11 p.m. would be limited to 3 events of recorded music and 3 live music. But before granting the application, the subcommittee added additional conditions designed to limit the impact of late-night noise on residents, including that levels should never exceed 70 decibels over a 15-minute period at pre-agreed monitoring locations. No music should be audible at those pre-agreed monitoring locations after 11 p.m. on any day. The committee's report states, "We consider the risk to the residential area is from noise late at night from the holding of events outside the school buildings, as there will be no structure to attenuate the noise. We have addressed this in our restriction on outside events." The conditions attached to the licence also stipulate that the sale and supply of alcohol cannot take place on the premises while they are being used for formal educational purposes.
And now, an item about the fulfilment of a dream by a writer and TV producer called Ian Brown. He used to write for this newspaper, but 30 years on, he's now published his first book for children, and it's called Albert Upside Down. It was published last week and is the first in a heartwarming new series from TV writer Ian Brown and animation director Ian Clark. Ian Brown says, "The last time I wrote for this newspaper was 30 years ago. A lot has happened between then, but I remember then the area and my colleagues vividly. Nowadays, often better than when I've just had for breakfast. I'm thrilled to be writing here again to celebrate the first publication of my book for children, Albert Upside Down. The fulfillment of a dream held since before my time as a reporter. Dozens of attempts to get published floundered over the decades as my career switched from junior reporter at the Hearts Advertiser to national reporter, TV news and writer and producer of primetime television shows. I've written or produced for Top Gear, The South Bank Show, This Is Your Life, The Simpsons, working with hundreds of household names, including Harrison Ford, Piers Brosnan, Simon Cowell, Anton Deck, Sharon Stone, Des O'Connor, George Lucas, Martin Kemp, Bruce Forsyth, Gordon Ramsay, Davina McCall, Trevor McDonald, and YouTubers Joe Sugg and Casper Lee. It amazes me and seems a long way from the hundreds of hours spent covering parish, town and county councils, magistrates and coroner's courts, golden and diamond weddings, plus the Heart Show with its livestock and colourful characters. I always wanted to be a writer. I thought working on TV might be nice. When I left school, because my father had died 2 years previously, I felt I should work rather than go to university. A handwritten letter to the BBC, there were no emails back then, went unanswered. A job at a local shoe shop followed, as did many more letters to the BBC, now typed as I'd invested in a typewriter. Eventually, the BBC did respond. At an interview, I was advised journalism might be a way into television. A year's training at Harlow Technical College, as it was, taught me the basics of speed typing. Between TV contracts, I was trying to write book details. Eventually, I struck upon an idea featuring the family pet tortoise, Albert. It was rescued by my wife when she was a little girl 50 years previously. Real Albert lives with us still. He could be 80. Illustrated by Ian Clark, my colleague on the Grown Ups cartoon show, Bruvs, a series of Albert books was born. Now the first series, the first in a series of picture books for 3+ years, and tortoise fans of all sizes, is being published by Graphic. There are also e-books and an animated e-book. 30 years between my first writing job on this paper and now seem to have passed in a blur. Getting a book published took all that time and is as much a landmark for me as my start here. As I'm on about a tortoise, what is it they say about slow but sure? Albert Upside Down by Ian Brown and Eon Clark is published by Graphic and is available to order now from local bookshops.
Things to do. Lovers of William Shakespeare can watch an online performance of the Bard's rarely performed classic King Lear live from a Hertfordshire theatre next week. St Albans director Joe Emery is producing an abridged version of the tragedy at the Pump House Theatre in Watford, with a cast including actors from all corners of Herts. King Lear is one of Shakespeare's less regularly performed plays, notably due to its 3.5 hour plus running time. With this in mind, St Albans-based theatre company Joe Emery Productions is bringing a modern, abridged adaptation to the Pump House Theatre in a live-streamed production via YouTube from Wednesday, May the 12th to Saturday, May the 15th. Director Joe Emery spent several months trimming the play down to a more manageable length. Theatre makers often shy away from one of Shakespeare's masterpieces because of the sheer size of the undertaking, said Joe. My adaptation brings the play up to date into our current era and references themes that we are all too familiar with nowadays, namely mental health, homelessness and knife crime. The cast have been rehearsing for a few months over Zoom calls and hail from both different areas of Herts and Bucks. They're all excited to be able to get back on stage. Even though we aren't allowed a live audience, live streaming has taken off so much in the last year, and technology has really stepped up to help bring theatre into our homes. The play is set in the corporate world, with Lear as the CEO dividing up his property development business empire between his three daughters. The onset of dementia has made his behaviour erratic and dangerous, and threats of a hostile French corporate takeover bid are circling. His rash decision to give up all his power has devastating and fatal consequences for him, his family and executives. The production is online only, with no live audience allowed, and will be live streamed at 7:45 nightly, with virtual doors open at 7:30 from May the 12th to May the 15th. Tickets are priced at £14 and must be purchased before 5:45 on each night of the performance in order to obtain the YouTube streaming link in time.
West End stars announced for musical theatre concerts. West End performers will take to the stage at this summer's Roman Theatre Open Air Festival. Cobbles and Rhyme Creatives have announced cast details for two exclusive concert performances of musical theatre favourites at the Roman Theatre of Verulamium on Sunday, July the 11th. The two St Albans shows are Showtime, Hits from Hollywood, Broadway and Beyond, and Family Show, A Spoonful of Musicals. Starring in both
will be Meryl Ansah, recently announced as Heather Duke in the upcoming UK tour of smash hit musical Heathers, and Alistair Soh, most recently seen in the West End production of The Phantom of the Opera as Raoul, Vicomte de Chagny understudy. Meryl also recently appeared in Disney's The Lion King at the Lyceum Theatre. Jessica Aubrey, whose credits include Sandy in Grease with the Royal Caribbean and Elsa in Frozen at Disneyland Paris, and Jack Reitman, an off-West End award winner for Thrill Me, will also perform in the concerts produced by Cobbles and Rhyme Productions. Jack Reitman, co-director of Cobbles and Rhyme, said, "We're ecstatic to announce our incredible cast for these two exclusive performances and can't wait to get back on a stage after a 15-month break from live theatre and music. We've put together two brilliant shows that are certain to have audiences enthralled, and we're delighted to be performing at the stunning 2,000-year-old Roman Theatre in St Albans as part of the Roman Theatre Open Air Festival. Showtime hits from Hollywood, Broadway and beyond on Sunday, July the 11th at 5 p.m. will feature 2 hours of your favourite songs from the greatest musicals, including Les Miserables, Wicked and Jersey Boys. A Spoonful of Musicals can be seen on the same day at 1 p.m. and is a practically perfect hour-long treat designed for the whole family. The show is jam-packed with musical theatre favourites for all ages, including Annie, Matilda, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and many, many more. Both shows will feature live piano accompaniment from John Reddell, with musical direction by Harry Hayden Brown and direction by Jack Reitman."
And now a list of deaths as announced in the Hertfordshire Advertiser. Michael Carter, aged 83. Eileen Sinden, 92. Darrell William Roberts, 84. And Nigel Maddock, aged 83. A little more music from Goffby now, followed by John Cushing reading the National Radio listings.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights. And starting with Saturday, May 8th. The Saturday drama on Radio 4 at 2 p.m. is Politics, Philosophy and Economics, a satire by Mark Lawson. You may think PPE has another connotation in these times of COVID. Opera on 3 at 6:30 is Rolsaka by Vorjak, starring René Fleming. For an evening of classic comedy, go to Radio 4 Extra at 7 p.m. where in Somebody Laughed, you'll find such delights as The Morecambe and Wise Show and The Ken Dodd Show, amongst others. David Meller's Melodies at 9 p.m. on Classic FM features listeners' suggestions and ideas. Sunday, May 9th, three dramas and a varied selection of music on offer. If you heard part one of Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead last Sunday, you won't want to miss the conclusion at 3 o'clock on Radio 4. The theme of this week's Words and Music on Radio 3 at 5:30 is Nature and the City, in which urban green spaces and wildlife are celebrated. In Burning Aeneid at 8 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra, the poet Virgil asks for his works to be burnt after his death, causing a furore. Sunday night is Music Night on Radio 2 at 7 p.m. Ed Balls indulges his musical love in a special concert with musical theatre stars performing stage hits. followed at 9pm by Seth Wakeman's Folk Map of the British Isles. The singer and fiddle player starts his musical journey in Scotland. Alternatively, also at 9pm on Classic FM, Music for Monarchy with Debbie Wiseman features instruments from royal collections with music by Handel, Chopin and others. Onto the programmes then that are serialised from Monday to Friday. Same radio station at the same time every day of the week, Monday to Friday. The Book of the Week on Radio 4 at 9:45am and then repeated at 12:30 is Other Minds, The Octopus and the Evolution of Intelligent Life. It sounds unlikely, but promises to be amazing. Nagat Munchetti has the 10am slot on Radio 5 Live from Monday to Wednesday, with Adrian Charles taking over for Thursday and Friday. News, interviews and listeners' experiences through to 1. Hardy's Women, The Woodlanders, continues from last week at 10:45 on Radio 4 and is repeated at 7:45 each night. The Composer of the Week on Radio 3 at noon is Robert Schumann. Lean Fall Stand at just after midday, every day, Monday to Friday on Radio 4 and repeated at 10:45 in the evening, continues from last week. And in Questions Answered at 1:45 on Radio 4, Chris Mason and Anita Anand meet callers to any questions to see how they found the experience. The sixth and final series of the crime thriller, The Corrupted, can be heard on Radio 4 Monday to Thursday at 2pm, and it will be continued next week. And the Classic FM concert with John Suchet is at 8pm. This week, the classical music alphabet from Albinoni to Zipoli. On to the rest of the shows then that you might want to listen to Monday to Friday, starting with Monday, May 10th. Round 10 of 12 in Round Britain Quiz at 3 o'clock on Radio 4. Beyond Belief at 4:30 on Radio 4 explores the misunderstood religion of voodoo. The subject of this week's Crossing Continents at 8:30pm on Radio 4 is Myanmar, the Spring Revolution, when it's revealed how three people have been documenting the brutality of the military coup there. The Blues Show with Keris Matthews is at 9pm on Radio 2. And if you missed last week's Word of Mouth, it's repeated at 11pm on Radio 4. Michael Rosen talks with the speech and language therapists who helped him recover from COVID-19. On to Tuesday, May 11th, when you can hear the final Word of Mouth in the current series. Michael talks to the author of Because Internet about how fandom is creating a whole new language. Comedy at 6:30 on Radio 4 with a new series of Alex Edelman's Peer Group. To Radio 4 Extra at 7, The Goon Show and King Street Junior at 7:30. The Jazz Show with Jamie Cullum is at 9 on Radio 2. For followers of The Archers, this week's All in the Mind hears from fans about the emotional pull of the storyline concerning Alice's depression and alcoholism. It's on Radio 4 at 9pm on Tuesday. Wednesday, May 12th takes us on a visit to Linton and Lynmouth when Mark Steele's In Town at 11:30 on Radio 4. Thinking Aloud at 4pm on Radio 4 looks at the history of blackface and minstrels and discusses the origins of the black and white minstrel show. The Delights of Hancock's Half Hour are on offer at 7pm on Radio 4 Extra, followed at 7:30 by No Commitments. Radio 3 concert at 7:30 has two Haydn symphonies and Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 23. The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe is at 9 o'clock on Radio 2. And 9 o'clock, Radio 4 Extra, I think I've mentioned this for the last 2 or 3 weeks, the inimitable P.G. Woodhouse, celebrated by Alexander Armstrong, with his characters brought to life by Michael Horden, Richard Briers and Simon Cadell. Music pretty much dominates on Thursday, May 13th. In A Life in Music at 11:30am on Radio 4, a music journalist speaks to musicians, psychologists and neuroscientists about how fundamental music is at each stage of our lives. The Opera Matinee on Radio 3 at 2pm is Monteverdi's The Return of Ulysses, a Royal Opera production staged at the Roundhouse. In the open air at 3 o'clock on Radio 4, when Ramblings takes us on a trip to the Peak District with Claire Balding. Great Lives at 6:30 on Radio 4 Extra looks at the life of Neville Chamberlain, followed at 7pm by I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again. A rather different concert at 7:30 on Radio 3, leading musicians from all genres were invited to create music inspired by the Baroque and Latin America Kubarok, while in folk baroque the musicians celebrate the huge role folk and dance has played in European art music. Finally, for Thursday on Radio 2, the country show, Bob Harris, 9 p.m. And to the final day of the week, Friday, May 14th, and it's a fair cop at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4. Ex-PC turned comedian Alfie Moore talks about the police role in sudden deaths. Going on past form, he'll probably make the subject both humorous and informative. Talawa Theatre are marking their 35th anniversary with a selection of radio plays. This week, NSA, starring Don Gillet, is at 2:15 on Radio 4. It's also interesting to hear other people's opinions on the week's programmes, and you can hear that on Feedback at 4:30 on Radio 4. Tony Blackburn has The Golden Hour at 7 p.m. on Radio 2, with an eclectic mix of pop and soul oldies, and no doubt some bad jokes. The Radio 3 concert at 7:30 has works by Prokofiev, Ravel, Mozart and Haydn. And Meeting Myself Coming Back this week has Dame Kelly Holmes reliving key moments from her life and career as she battled injury and self-harm while she trained for the Atlanta Olympics and her involvement in bringing the 2012 Olympics to London. May I wish you, as ever, a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week of radio listening.
Thank you very much, John. Now, another from our series, London Beyond Sight. This week, Lynn Featherston on Alexandra Palace. This is one of the many fascinating items that can be found on the Vocalise London Beyond Sight website.
Hello, I'm Lynn Featherstone, Liberal Democrat MP for Hornsey and Wood Green. And I've been the MP for Hornsey and Wood Green since 2005, but before that I was for 8 years a councillor, a local councillor on Haringey Council. So, it would be very hard for me not to choose Alexandra Palace, a splendid, mysterious palace on top of the hill right in the middle of my constituency. Growing up here knowing that you had a palace named after a princess. It's an iconic, magical palace. The place I used to go skating. The birthplace of TV. And a building that has burned down twice and has twice risen from the ashes. The palace is enormous, nearly 300 metres across, and it's surrounded by a steeply sloping park. It's made of pale yellow brick with circular patterns picked out in orange. First opened in 1873, it was known as the People's Palace, intended for public recreation. In true Victorian style, the architect, John Johnson, realised that vision on a grand scale. The design borrows from classical architecture. There's a central facade, some 50 metres high, with a huge rose window set into a recessed arch and a triangular roof. To either side of the rose, there are blanked arched windows with panels painted onto them in blue outlines, and just beneath are four arches lined with orange brick. The palace is much wider than it is tall. At each end, there's a rectangular tower. The main entrances to the building are positioned on the sides. The right tower has a TV aerial sticking out of the top, a four-sided metal structure a bit like a mini Eiffel Tower, with a long straight aerial shooting out of the top. And this dates from 1935, when the BBC leased the Eastern Wing and transmitted the first ever TV signals from here. It still transmits signals today. Both East and West Towers are joined to the central facade by long galleries, like two layers of cloisters, one on top of the other. On the west side, the top gallery forms a covered walkway, and the arches are opened out onto the elements. It is crying out for a restaurant to be put there with the finest views of London. Set further back, there's the glass roof of the Palm Court, a tiled court with fully grown palm trees inside, and on the east side, there's a building immediately behind the arches, housing an ice rink. The design might sound imposing, like a cathedral perhaps, but the colourful brickwork and bright blue window frames tell us what this place is really all about. Pleasure. At the peak of the triangular roof, there's a person-sized statue of a winged angel carved in grey stone. She's holding a laurel wreath, and at her feet there's a fat sheath of corn and a horn of plenty. Loosely based on Ceres, she represents fruitfulness and the good life. She has one arm raised in the air, finger pointed, as if she's just stepped out of one of the raves that they now hold downstairs. A wide viewing platform spans the palace, made of yellow brick and edged with blue railings. Two sets of steps lead up from a road that runs along the front of the building, one set on the left and one on the right. I can imagine Victorian Londoners climbing the wide steps to promenade in front of the galleries and take in the views of the whole city. Today, it's the skyscrapers of Canary Wharf and the new tapering glass construction, the Shard, that grab your attention. The park slopes down in front of you, full of people picnicking, walking their dogs, playing sport, anything they want. Alley Pally, as it is widely known, is used for all kinds of events. Gigs, the Christmas Arts Fair, and my particular favourite, the Knitting and Stitching Show. Although, since I became an MP, my last jumper took 7 years to knit. These all take place in the beautiful halls that lie behind the facade. The Great Hall is on the other side of the Rose Window, a huge space, 100 metres long and 50 metres wide. Its high glass roof curves like a barrel. From the outside, the Rose Window is muted metallic blue like mother of pearl, split into angular geometric panes. But from inside the hall, it shows a 10-pointed star in bright blue and yellow. The history of Alexandra Palace hasn't all been one of elegant Victorian leisure pursuits. It is rather more chequered, as the other side of the building suggests. The entire north face is in disrepair, shut off to the public, stained black with smoke, its windows grey and boarded up. Just 16 days after opening, the palace was all but destroyed by a fire, leaving only the exterior shell in place. It was swiftly rebuilt and reopened in 1875. And during the First World War, the palace became an internment camp for German prisoners. A plaque commemorating this is displayed near the Eastern Tower. Later, in World War II, the TV aerial was used to jam the navigation systems of German bombers. In 1980, sadly, a second major fire destroyed half of the building, and this is the damage that remains today. Hidden in the disused parts of the building, there is a theatre, with some of its Victorian stage machinery preserved, and at the moment, it can only be accessed on special open days. The palace is a glittering, splendid place that dominates the view for miles around, but also a run-down building desperate to be restored and used. It can't stand still. A consultation has just been held to find out how it can best be enjoyed by people today, and plans are afoot to bring the whole place back to its former glory.
More music now, and here's the full-length version of Happy Strumming by Gothby. I hope you enjoyed the New York vocalised description of the Grand Central Terminus last month. This time, Beth Gorry on the Staten Island Ferry. One of the best things you can do for free in New York.
Hi, I'm Beth Gorry, director of Staten Island Out Loud, a grassroots project that sponsors free performances and readings of world classics, historic texts, and other compelling works. I live on Staten Island and ride the Staten Island Ferry every day to and from Manhattan. It's a magical experience every time for me, and I'm happy to describe the ferry for you. But first, a little background. The City of New York has run the ferry since 1905. It operates 24 hours a day, every day of the year, and it carries 60,000 people every weekday between the St. George Terminal on Staten Island and the Whitehall Terminal at the foot of Manhattan. The journey is 5.2 miles and takes about 25 minutes, and it's free. The ferry boat is bright orange, supposedly because it's easier to see in fog and snow. There are three different sized ferries. From the shore, all of them look long and wide. The newest are 300 feet long as a football field, and 70 feet wide. They can carry 4,400 people, and some ferries used to carry cars, though no cars have been allowed on the ferry since the tragedy of September 11th. On the long side of the ferries, the name Staten Island Ferry is written in blue cursive script. Each ferry has open decks at each end to make it easy for people to stream on and off. You can also stand on those decks during the ride for a windy experience that puts you just a few feet above the churning water. When you look at the ferries on their long sides, you'll see three levels of windows indicating the three interior decks of the ferry. There's plenty of bench seating on all decks. On some of the older ferries, the upper level has an open deck with a handrail along the side of the ferry so you can ride outside. The top of the ferries, called hurricane decks, have two pilot houses, one at each end, where the captain commands the ship. Also, the top decks of the newest ferries have marvelous little rooms like perches or crow's nests. These little spots are far away from the crowd, and you might feel as if you're the captain and you have the whole boat to yourself. Of course, to describe the ferry, I have to talk about the experience of riding it, not just what it looks like. The trip gives you a chance to enjoy all the sights of the harbor, including the silver skyscrapers of Manhattan rising from the water like the City of Oz, the Statue of Liberty, Ellis Island, and in the distance, the Verrazano Bridge. But beyond what you can see, the trip is a treat for your ears, too. I find the sounds of the ferry soothing. They give me a sense of peace, even when commuting to work. You'll hear the sounds of the boat horn as it pulls out of the slip, and you may hear foghorns on a misty day. As you pass the buoys in the harbor, their bells jangle as they bob in the waves. You'll hear the call of seagulls as they soar alongside the ferry. Step outside, and you'll hear the sound of water splashing against the hull. And you'll hear the groan of the wooden piers as the ferry scrapes against them, pulling into the terminal. I think it's always a special trip, and I encourage you to ride the Staten Island Ferry. If you're a New Yorker, you'll feel like a tourist in your own city. And remember, it's free!
Before I finish with the week in history, here's an item from the Talking News Federation. Spring is nearly upon us, apparently, so Nikki reads Lynn Gibson's description of one of Botticelli's most famous paintings, Primavera.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, I'm Nikki. And as it begins to look like spring is finally on its way, here is my recording of the description by Lynn Gibson, MA, of one of the most well-known of Sandro Botticelli's paintings, Primavera. Lynn delighted us in the winter with her description of the famous Bruegel painting, Hunters in the Snow, and here she again draws on her extensive experience of lecturing in the history of art to bring us this beautifully evocative piece.
Sandro Botticelli's Primavera from around 1478, Tempera on Panel, from the Uffizi Museum in Florence, Italy. It's April, the month of Venus, and we are walking through the Palazzo Gardens across a lawn studded with a tapestry of jewel-like flowers. The air is clear and warm, alive with the hum of insects and the sweet, sharp scent of citrus. Something catches our attention. Melodic voices carried on the soft breeze. We enter a shady orange grove and find ourselves stepping into an otherworldly scene. The arrival of spring has brought the gods to earth. A vision of paradise has appeared to us in this secret spot. The central figure, a fair and elegant young woman, glances towards us and raises a hand in a gesture of welcome. She wears a long, flowing white dress and blue and red shawl, richly embroidered with golden thread. Her slender figure sways slightly, echoing the circular dance of three young girls, clad in diaphanous robes. Above her head flies an infant, far too chubby to be airborne, and in spite of being blindfolded, he has removed an arrow from his quiver and aims it at the central dancer below. The dancer glances to the left, towards a handsome young man, wearing a helmet, winged sandals, and a sword slung on a baldric. At present, though, he looks away from the seductive trio, up into a patch of wispy clouds peeping through the leafy canopy. He points at the clouds with a curiously shaped golden staff entwined with serpents, perhaps to dispel this last vestige of winter. Over to the far right of the tableau, another young man suddenly appears, flying into the grove between two laurel trees. He is a soft grey-blue in skin and dress, his cheeks puffed to expel a gentle, westerly wind. He grasps a young maiden. She turns in surprise, flowers pouring from her open mouth. Unable to escape the wind's embrace, the maiden transforms into a beautiful woman. Her simple white transparent gown becomes a floral dress. Circlets of multicoloured blooms adorn her brow and neck. She walks towards us, smiling, casting roses onto the grass at our feet. We turn quietly to leave, unwilling to intrude upon the mysterious rituals of the gods any longer, and retrace our steps over the palazzo lawn, through the clear, warm air of spring.
TNF Soundings.
Now some noteworthy events for this week from history. On the 9th of May in 1941, British intelligence at Bletchley Park broke German spy codes after the capture of Enigma machines. On this day in 1945, the Channel Islands were formally liberated following occupation by German troops. And on the 9th of May in 1949, Britain's first laundrette opened in Queensway, London. On the 10th of May in 1940, the first German bombs of the Second World War to fall on England landed in Kent. In 1994, Nelson Mandela was sworn in as South Africa's first black president. And on the 10th of May in 2016, an Indian fertility clinic announced that a 70-year-old woman had successfully given birth to a baby boy. On the 11th of May in 1812, the waltz was introduced into English ballrooms, with some observers declaring it disgusting and immoral. Also in 1812, Spencer Perceval became the only serving British Prime Minister to be assassinated. On the 11th of May in 1985, 56 people died and 265 were injured at the Bradford City football ground in the worst fire in English football history. And on the 11th of May in 1987, the first heart-lung transplant took place. On the 12th of May in 1789, William Wilberforce made his first major House of Commons speech on the abolition of slavery. In 1937, the coronation of King George VI took place at Westminster Abbey. And on the 12th of May in 1942, records show that at least 1,500 Jewish people were gassed at the German concentration camp Auschwitz. On the 13th of May in 1940, at his first speech as Prime Minister, Winston Churchill announced that he had nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. On the 13th of May in 1981, Pope John Paul II was shot and critically wounded in St. Peter's Square. On the 14th of May in 1796, Edward Jenner administered the first inoculation against smallpox. In 1940, the British Local Defence Volunteers were formed, later renamed the Home Guard. In 1948, Israel declared independence from British administration. And on the 14th of May in 1986, Anne Frank's complete diary was published. And finally, on the 15th of May in 1897, the Scientific Humanitarian Committee was founded in Berlin, the first ever LGBT rights organisation. In 1921, the British Legion was formed to care for ex-servicemen. And in 2010, Jessica Watson, age 16, became the youngest person to sail solo, non-stop, and unassisted around the world. Here are some well-known people whose birth dates fall this week. On the 9th of May in 1936, English actor Albert Finney was born in Salford. He attended the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, RADA, and worked in theatre before attaining prominence on screen with The Entertainer. Albert Finney's last film performance was in Skyfall, the 23rd James Bond film, in 2012. On the 10th of May in 1957, Simon John Ritchie, known professionally as Sid Vicious, was born in Lewisham, London. He was the bassist for punk rock band The Sex Pistols, and was famous for his edgy, rebellious persona and self-destructive tendencies. His name came about when fellow band member Johnny Rotten's hamster, Sid, bit him on the finger, and he exclaimed, "Sid's vicious." On the 11th of May in 1904, Salvador Dali was born. The Spanish surrealist artist was renowned for his technical skill, precise draftsmanship, and the striking and bizarre images in his work, which include The Persistence of Memory, Melting Clocks, and Lobster Telephone. On the 12th of May, Katharine Horton Hepburn, the American actress of film, stage, and television, was born in 1907. Hepburn's career as a Hollywood leading lady spanned more than 60 years. She starred in The African Queen, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and The Philadelphia Story, amongst many others. On the 13th of May in 1950, Steveland Hardaway Morris, known professionally as Stevie Wonder, was born 6 weeks prematurely and developed retinopathy of prematurity, from which he became blind. As well as being a singer and record producer, he is one of the most successful songwriters and musicians ever, with a string of hits including Isn't She Lovely?, I Just Called to Say I Love You?, and Superstition. On the 14th of May in 1944, George Walton Lucas Jr. was born in California. The American producer and screenwriter is best known for creating the Star Wars and Indiana Jones film franchises. And finally, on the 15th of May in 1987, Sir Andrew Baron Murray, or Andy Murray, was born in Glasgow. The British professional tennis player has won 3 Grand Slams and was ranked world number one by the Association of Tennis Professionals for 41 weeks and finished as the year-end number one in 2016. And that finishes up this edition of Primary. My thanks to Gilly, Deborah, Jane, Christine, Jess, Andy, Keith and David for reading the news, to Angela for providing the radio listings, and to John who read them. Thanks also to Lynn Featherston and Beth Gorry, to all at TNF Soundings, Wendy, Sean and Chris for the week in history and famous birthdays, and, as always, to Rob Pearman for all his support. Primary will be back in 4 weeks' time. Before I finish, I wanted to mention a couple of scams that happened to me last week. The first was a telephone call purporting to be from HMRC, the Inland Revenue, informing me that a lawsuit was being taken out against me for unpaid taxes. At first hearing, this would be worrying for anybody, but it was a recorded message in an American accent. So, probably a hoax then. I also received a text message, apparently from HSBC, my bank, stating that a Mr. K. Adams had withdrawn £670 from my account. On this occasion, I did show it to one of the few remaining staff at HSBC in St. Albans, don't get me started on that, and he pointed out that the message was sent from a mobile number. In any case, the bank wouldn't contact any customer like that, let alone from a mobile. And finally, I had another text message saying that my national insurance number was being deactivated and guided me to a link to re-verify it. I declined to do that and deleted the message immediately. This is a rather long-winded way of saying, please, please be aware of hoaxes like this. Some of them are very plausible. When in doubt, just delete. And for those of you with pets, please keep them safe. There are some unsavoury people out there. And finally, before I go, we've received the following items that have been donated to us from some listeners. A Clearview autofocus desktop magnification system, which would enable you to enjoy reading, writing, and viewing photographs, and doing crafts, and lots more. Its simple operation provides magnification of text and objects in different colours, with adjustable brightness and contrast. This item would need to be collected from St Albans. We also have a similar item which would need to be collected from Harpenden. We also have two corded telephones which have very large keypads. These could be delivered to you. If you are interested in any of the above items, please contact Robin Christofuru on 01727 866 725. That's Robin on 01727 866 725. And of course, all these items are free of charge. Please remember to return your USB stick and wallet after use, and please stay well and safe at home. I wish you a safe and vaccinated May.